Greetings and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm your host, Monica Black. And as you know, our job at New Books in History is to pick out exciting new books that the world needs to know about and interview their authors. And that's what we're going to do today. I have the pleasure this fine day of speaking with Ellen Boucher. Ellen is assistant professor of history at Amherst College. And her book is called Empire's Children, Child Migration, Welfare, and the Decline of the British World, 1869 to 1967. It appeared last year with Cambridge University Press. I understand that a paperback is in the works, which is a good thing because, as we know, Cambridge books are expensive. And it has been getting some really, really fine reviews. So, Ellen, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, and thanks for plugging the paperback.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to get right into the book, so I wonder if I could first ask you, please, to tell us briefly about its subject and, you know, sort of what is the story that you tell in this book over roughly a 100-year period?
Sure. So it's actually two stories that I tell, and the first is really just the human story. It's about roughly 95,000 children from poor, underprivileged backgrounds, British children, who ranged between the ages of about 5 and 13, who were selected for resettlement in the settler dominions of Canada, Australia, Southern Rhodesia, and New Zealand over this period of time from 1869 to 1967. So the book charts the rise and fall of this movement to resettle children in various parts of the empire and looks at the interactions between charities, British and settler governments, educators, the children themselves, and their parents. And so it tries to recapture the story of why this policy, which to us now seems very unfamiliar and even somewhat abhorrent, once made sense both politically and culturally. And so to tell that story, I also tell a larger story, which is about the changing relationship between Britain and its settler colonies during the late 19th and 20th centuries. So I use the policy to chart the fragmentation of a particular vision of the empire, what was known at the time as the idea of Greater Britain, or sometimes it was called the British World. And this was the idea that the settler territories were naturally, even organically, connected to Britain through the ties of a shared culture, shared traditions, shared racial makeup. And so in this case, the lens of child migration helps me tell this story of how and why the belief in a global British culture and a global British race gradually fell apart by the late 20th century. And so the question that really motivated that side of the book was, how did we get from a point where the various settler regions of the empire identified first and foremost as British, and it seems very straightforward and perfectly plausible to send a British child from one side of the world to another, to the point where we are now, where a place like Canada or Australia identifies as its own separate national culture, and when, you know, it seems politically and culturally unthinkable to take children and transplant them in this way.
Yeah, absolutely right. You know, and I'll say this, but also, you know, some of the people who have reviewed the book have said the same thing, that, you know, as you know, when we study history, we're always confronted with the fact that a thing that seemed really wonderful just, you know, a few generations ago, or even, you know, less than that, can later come to appear deplorable. And I often had that feeling reading your book, and some of the people who have reviewed it have. And I think that one of the things that's one of the hallmarks of the book, I think, is the sensitivity with which you explore what you call the human side of this policy. In other words, the actual individuals involved in it, the children and their parents often. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about yourself now that you've kind of given us a glimpse into the book's content. I wonder if you can tell us a bit about yourself and how you arrived at this topic and how you researched it, because I gather that involved quite a lot of traveling.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And as you say, you know, it was really important to me to try to not just tell a policy story or a political story, but also to tell the story of changing experiences over time and the ways in which those experiences have affected people's memories of their childhoods, of growing up in various regions of the world. And so I put together the research plan for the book in order to forefront that aspect, because I found it to be really important. But in any case, I came to the topic originally. It was my dissertation at Columbia University. And like many people, I sort of arrived at my research project haphazardly. I was in a course trying to find the topic of a seminar paper. I was taking a wonderful course with Frank Mort, who's a cultural historian who's now at the University of Manchester, but he was visiting Columbia at the time. And it was a course on space, sort of space and identity within Britain. And so I had this really large framework, and I had to figure out some way of crafting a seminar paper for it. And so I became interested in the idea of empire and migration, and started looking in that literature, and found this footnote to child migration, and realized that there was this really gripping story here that was fascinating and rich and analytically, meaningful. And there had been some good work published on it, but nothing terribly recently. So I started doing some research in that respect, and really found that this was a topic that I could sink my teeth into, and that would also take me to various parts of the world, which was a nice kind of side benefit of being a grad student and having the ability to travel. So I began my research in Britain, primarily in the National Archives and the University of Liverpool, that has a wonderful collection of social welfare organization archives. And I also started doing some oral history with former migrants in the UK. And from there, through connections that I made within the community, found that there were many, many more people around the world who were willing to talk to me. So from there, I also went to Australia and worked in a number of collections there, the National Archives, but also the Mitchell Library in Sydney. The National Library has some wonderful material related to child migration, and continued interviewing people. It was a wonderful way to get to know Australia. I'd never been there before, and I got to go to all these small towns located across the country to try to find people to interview. And finally, I ended up in South Africa, where there's a small community of former migrants, former child migrants, many of them who grew up in southern Rhodesia and then left Zimbabwe in the 1980s and 1990s and ended up in South Africa. So that was how I pieced together this story. And it was a wonderful project, because I really got to learn a lot about Greater Britain by actually experiencing it and traveling around it firsthand.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's very interesting. Yeah, I bet that I'm sure that did give you a different kind of sense. I mean, you were speaking about space and identity, and I would think that having had the experience of traveling in the footsteps of the people who about whom you were ultimately going to write had some effect on how you thought about space and empire and identity and all those sorts of things.
Well, absolutely. I mean, seeing what these places looked like and going to, for instance, one of the schools that received child migrants in Australia, and being able to be there on the ground and looking at how the architecture was set up and how the landscaping was structured. It was all very important to get a real understanding of the sorts of ways in which this policy used space very explicitly to cultivate a certain understanding of white British identity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me ask you this. Why children? I mean, why do children become the focus? I mean, why children are the focus of the policy is fairly clear. But what was it for you what did you learn over the course of writing the book, doing the research for, and then writing the book? What did you come to learn about the importance, let's say, of children politically and in other ways?
Right. Well, children have always been an important sort of category for the political imagination, because children aren't so much blank slates as they are malleable members of the population, or they're perceived as more malleable than adults who were, for most of the 20th century and most of the 19th century, seen as much more set in their ways and harder to transform or reform. Whereas children are really important politically because you can project many different realms of possibility onto them. And so what I found was that children become this category in which politicians can express numerous ideas about where they see their countries going in the future. And so children come to be this really excellent way of sort of molding a national vision, but also a vision of the empire. Children also appeared to be very vulnerable to what was thought of at the time as the ravages of poverty and the ravages of slum living. And so there was a sentimental attachment to childhood and to children that motivated a lot of concern around rescuing them and transporting them to environments where they would have a better chance in life. So doing this project really brought home to me one of the things that many historians within the history of childhood have emphasized, which is that children are just this very important sort of cultural symbol, and that symbolic importance leads to shaping their experiences in a number of really important ways.
Yeah, that really comes through in the book. I mean, the fact that children are such a very dense kind of symbol. They mean so many different things to different people. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how the actual resettling idea emerged in the Victorian era.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it emerged originally out of a number of debates about the effects of industrial poverty on metropolitan British society. So there were a number of reformers in the 1860s, 1870s, who were increasingly concerned about the seemingly entrenched problem of slum poverty, and especially concerned about whether the ravages of slum poverty were weakening the racial fitness of the population as a whole at a time when Britain was expanding its global influence overseas. So in the late 19th century, there seems to be a profound need for healthy, fit young Britons to go out into the empire to serve as soldiers or military officials or farmers and settlers. And yet there is the concern that the sort of the base of the population is not producing the healthy, fit people that were required for this. And so this seeming imperative to spread British stock around the world leads to a discussion about why there is such a seemingly entrenched problem of poverty. And the question is, are the poor poor because they are naturally sinful or somehow racially deficient? Or are they poor because they're stuck in an environment that is not conducive to cultivating the best and brightest of the population? And the reformers who become involved in child migration are very clearly part of the second explanation. They view the slum environment as debilitating towards young people, as warping their bodies, as corrupting their minds. And so what they think is the solution is to remove those children from that environment in order to give them a better chance in life to grow up healthy and strong, and to transfer them to wholesome environments, which they see as primarily located in the settler dominions. And so it's part, child migration is really part of a larger discussion about the nature of poverty and how it can be reformed. And rather than invest in reforming slum spaces within Britain, these particular reformers become very focused on removing the most vulnerable members of that population in order to transform them overseas. So it's a really good example of how the sort of social welfare imagination of the late 19th century is profoundly influenced by this vision of the empire that's grounded in ideas of British spaces overseas.
Yeah, this spatial theme that we keep coming back to is really interesting. I mean, it's actually something that I didn't think that hard about when I was reading the book, but now more and more I'm thinking about it as we talk. And obviously, a part of that imagination of that the kind of social welfare mentality of the late 19th century had something to do with, as we know, the idea that something about being cramped in cities or being perceived as being cramped in cities. I don't think we would think about it that way at all anymore. But something about being perceived to be cramped in a city, having a negative influence on the body and on the mind. And then the idea of these vast open spaces in places like Canada and Australia, where, you know, somehow that appeared literally as a kind of health benefit of its own, just to be in an open, free space that way.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of really interesting social mapping that goes on in this period that contrasts the very, as you say, cramped or tightly packed nature of slum neighborhoods with these maps of the empire, which are largely blank. And that, of course, is a complete construction in and of itself. But a way of juxtaposing this idea that Britain is overly full, it's overly populated, but look, there is this British realm that is overseas that is sort of ripe for settlement, and in which there's so much space for people to spread out and to kind of become whatever best self they wanted to become. And so there's this way in which the figure of the child as full of possibilities, if you could just shape them in the right way, is very closely connected to this image of the empire as full of possibilities that also need to be shaped. And so I was really interested in how the geographic imagination intersected with this imagination about children.
Yeah. So if one of the themes that we've hinted at already a number of times is the theme of space and the effects of space and on the imagination, on bodies, etc. Another of the major themes of the book, which again you've already sort of mentioned, but maybe we can develop it a bit more now, is that of race and eugenics. Of course, these spaces that we're talking about were often perceived as or conceived as, you know, being virtually empty, which of course they were not, but they were perceived that way. And race and eugenics plays a number of different evolving roles in this book. So if I could sort of break it down this way, there's a period up to the First World War, then there's a period after the First World War when there's another kind of sharp break, and then there's another sharp break after 1945. So can you talk a little bit about the theme of race and eugenics in this book?
Absolutely. I mean, I thought that this was a very interesting angle of the research that I wasn't necessarily looking for when I started working on the project, but then I found all over the archives, and so really came to influence my thinking in a lot of key ways. But doing this research really brought home for me what is a very basic idea, but I think still a really important point, that ideas about race are highly situated. And so political and cultural definitions of what it meant to be white in this period vary tremendously according to where you were in the empire and also what period you're talking about. So yes, there is a shift from a pre-World War I understanding of white racial Britishness to interwar moment and then into a post-war moment. And so what I found is that in the late 19th century and into the early 20th century, there is a widely shared idea that Britannic heritage or ethnicity was shared throughout the territories. And so what mattered was whether or not your parents were British. It didn't matter if they were born in Britain. What mattered was that they were of what was called British stock. And that basically meant that you were considered to be white in the period before the First World War. And that's why it's seen as fairly straightforward to take poor children from the Metropolitan Society and send them overseas to a place like Canada or Australia, because it's not seen as something that's jarring or introducing a different element. They're all British. But that starts to shift around the First World War, when there's a wave of settler nationalism that begins first to show its effects in Canada and then later in Australia, in which Dominion politicians and a number of reformers and medical people start to define their own local standards of white British, white racial fitness in ways that were different from how they were being thought about in Britain. And so while British reformers continue to say, you know, into the interwar period and really into the post-World War II period, that any British child could be remade into an ideal imperial citizen, increasingly their counterparts in the Dominions are skeptical about this. And they're setting standards of racial fitness that are at variance. So what I found, for instance, was children who were cleared, medically cleared for emigration within Britain by British doctors. And they'd get on the boat, and a couple of weeks later, they would disembark in Canada, and they would have another medical examination. And suddenly, they were found to be either degenerate or physically unfit or mentally unhealthy. And sometimes they would be repatriated right away, or sometimes this assessment would only appear a number of months or years even later. And then they would be sent back to Britain at that later period. And so their ideas on the ground in a place like Canada or Australia, they're increasingly being influenced by eugenic understandings of race that don't align with the kinds of thinking that are coming out of the UK at the same time period. And so that's really starts happening around the First World War. It gathers steam in a place like Australia in the 1930s, and then ends up migrating into a place like Southern Rhodesia, where you see the influence of eugenic and racial thinking really in the later 1930s and 1940s.
And how was this heightened eugenic consciousness, I guess that's what I'll say, how did that play out differently in different locations? As you pointed out, and of course you're absolutely right about the situatedness of race, what influence did those different situations of race, what influence did each of those situations have on ideas of eugenic fitness and ideas about quote-unquote racial preservation and things like that?
Right. Well, the case that I think I bring up most in the book, or the comparison that I bring up most in the book, is between Australia and Southern Rhodesia. And here you can see that the local concerns, political and cultural concerns of these two emerging nations, shape the ways in which eugenics and race is thought about and used in this policy in pretty clear ways. So in Australia, in the 1920s and 1930s, there's an increasing concern about the threat of Asian expansion. And a lot of politicians are worried about the proximity between Australia and countries like Japan and China, which seem to be quite overpopulated and aggressively expansionist. And there is a rhetoric around the movement of Asians out into Australia, and a concern that they will be sort of swamped by this other race. And so what Australian politicians really want are to have British settlers coming into the country to settle on sparsely populated parts of the Australian territory and to cultivate that land so that they can be a bulwark against the threat of Asian expansion. And so what happens, though, is that Australian notions of the ideal settler become increasingly shaped by a strong eugenic movement within the country. And so a number of medical doctors and reformers start to set standards of how eugenically fit the incoming migrants must be. And they come up with these arbitrary standards. Like, for instance, they have to have an IQ of over 100 points. And they need to have a body that's strong, and they can't have a squint or a stammer because that might indicate that they have some sort of mental imbalance. If they're a child, they can't demonstrate loneliness or depression or bedwetting. I mean, all of these things that to us now seem to be quite arbitrary, but at the time were seen as ways of protecting the Australian population and ensuring that all of the migrants coming in were as strong and healthy and had as much potential as possible. And so that's how the discourse sort of develops in Australia. If you go to Rhodesia, the concern was very different. I mean, there they have already a large African population. They're outnumbered 20-1 by Africans. And the Rhodesian settler minority wants to ensure that it can maintain its hierarchy, that it can maintain its leadership of the colony in the face of this demographic imbalance. And so there they want to bring in young settlers who are going to be not just farmers developing the countryside. They want them to be the leaders of the colony and the managers, the administrators, the officials. And so there they develop a different strain of thinking about race. They certainly want white people first and foremost, but they want to make sure that they demonstrate the sort of class-specific understandings of leadership in order to sort of cultivate the white population and make sure that it's going to maintain its control of the territory. And so they're much more concerned with the psychological background of child migrants, and they want to make sure that they come from good homes, that they haven't had any lasting traumas in their childhood, that they haven't been subject to extremes of poverty, because they don't want to import what they call an underclass who would not be able to lead the African population. They want to incorporate people who are going to be more middle class or even elite. And so they use just different standards of recruitment and racial fitness. There they have a much higher IQ that they look for within children. They also use social workers to try to ensure, to interview the children and their families, try to ensure that they're going to be this higher class that's stock of people. And so it's just very interesting to think about the ways in which these local concerns, these local political concerns, shape the ways in which race is thought about and end up influencing the policy in this very distinct ways.
Yes, it's very interesting how in the different contexts that you examine, Southern Rhodesia, Canada, Australia, the way that race and gender and class, particularly race and class, I would say, come together in very different ways in each of those different situations. I thought that was one of the really revealing things about the book. I wonder if we can and now maybe change directions a little bit in the conversation and talk. We've talked quite a lot about the policies that were developed around the child migrant policy and the various kind of attendant ideas that made it up. I wonder if we can now maybe shift gears a little bit and talk about the experiences of some of the people who were the targets of this policy and some of the children who actually, you know, became child migrants. You have, I think my favorite chapter in the book is the one that is called, I think it's called Crafting Australians. And because I think one of the reasons that I liked it especially was because you were able to show quite a lot of good detail how children lived in Australia, what kinds of expectations the sort of the people sort of instituting the policy on the ground had for the children, what kinds of activities they wanted them to be involved in to sort of build up their, you know, young bodies and their attitudes towards whatever it was that they wanted their attitudes, whatever sort of direction they wanted their thinking to be built up in. And so I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, about those, maybe the, using the Australian children as an example, maybe talk about what it was like for those kids to be child migrants and what sorts of experiences they had.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think that a really interesting part of this story is the way in which the setting and the pedagogy for children was structured in very explicit ways, but also the ways in which children responded to that structuring and how they found their own avenues for rebellion or resistance or just being their own people within this framework, which is very highly constructed. Yeah. So in Australia, as I said before, the goal is to get young, malleable people into the country so that they can go work in rural spaces and that they can become farmers and cultivate the land. So they want to plant sort of British children across the country and send them to very remote places. But it's a problem because how do you take children who have been raised in an urban setting, who've only known city life, and turn them into these farmers by the age of the school leaving age of 14. And so what the policymakers decide to do is to create this farm school model where children would grow up on a farm in this collective environment. They would be placed in little, what were called cottage homes, but they're really small dorms between, they'd have about 12 to 14 children living in this home together under the direction of what was called a cottage mother or a matron. And their whole day would be structured around allowing them to appreciate the benefits of rural living. So they'd go and attend a local primary school in the mornings. And in the afternoons, they would spend their time out on the farm, working in the fields, doing chores around the house. You know, girls would plant and weed the garden. They'd tend the chickens. They would do a range of domestic chores that were intended to sort of teach them the skills that they would need when they go out into the world and become farmers' wives. Boys would go and do heavier work around the farm. They'd plow, they'd milk cows, and things like that. And then at the age of between 12 and 14, they'd enter a training program that was designed to give them the skills that they would need to become independent farmers in their future lives. And so there they would stop going to school and they would dedicate their entire day to various aspects of training, working. They'd have rotations where they'd work on the fields for a few weeks and then they'd work in the dairy for a few weeks and then they might work in the bakery for a few weeks. So it's all very, very constructed. But what I found very interesting about this is that on the one hand, the intent is to give children the skills to be independent farmers so that they could grow up and own their own farms and set themselves up on the land. That's the long-term goal. But the short-term goal is that at the age of between 14 and 16, they're going to be placed out in very remote farms where they're going to be working in menial positions as farm hands or farm servants. Mm-hmm. Because you can't give a 14-year-old his own farm. You know, there's going to be a period where they're just going to be working out on the land on their own and sort of developing their career. And so in order to get that short-term goal realized, they also had to teach these children how to be very, really submissive, or at least to be willing to take on very difficult jobs in very remote settings that were often very lonely and that were extremely poorly paid. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in the 1930s, at the height of the Depression, there's a lot of antagonism towards the idea that British children will be coming in and taking jobs away from locally born Australian children. And so the way they solve or they fight back against that hostility is to say, well, they're taking these very low paid jobs that many Australian children don't want. And the reason why many Australian children don't want them is because Australian children want to be close to their families. And they say, well, these children don't have any families, so we can send them out into the more remote areas. And so there's this real tension in terms of how the children are raised. They want to, on the one hand, be independent and self-sufficient, but on the other hand, to be really kind of exploited labor. And so within this, you get a range of responses among the former migrants who grew up in this environment. And many of them talked really eloquently about how for them, the most important thing was finding a way to have kind of a culture unto themselves, you know, playing little games on their own time that had nothing to do with farming. Mm. And some people talked about the fact that they never wanted to be a farmer, that they were sick of cows and they'd never wanted to be around them. And so for them, they lost themselves in books, or, you know, they would spend their entire time, you know, going on long walks, trying to get away from the pressure of becoming a farmer. So it was really interesting to see the ways in which not only this whole framework was structured to create a certain type of individual, but also how these individuals actually responded to that and in many cases resisted that pressure.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Let's move in time a little bit forward now to the period just after the Second World War, which is a major turning point in your book. Of course, it's a major turning point in a lot of people's books, so it's not that surprising. But one of the things that's interesting about 1945 as a turning point for you has to do with child psychology, changing ideas about how children's minds work. And you talked about in the book, you talked about how during World War II, as we know, in a lot of countries, children were evacuated out of cities to avoid the urban bombing campaigns, or in London, for example, the Blitz. They were separated from their families. And after World War II, people suddenly, it's a very interesting kind of intersection with your book, people suddenly say, oh, you know, removing children from their families is disastrous, it's horrendous, how can such a thing happen? And then this changes immediately almost the way, or very quickly, the way that people think about the child migration program. So I wonder if you could talk about kind of the child migration program and how it responds to changing ideas about mothers and love and families and child psychology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so during the war, as you've mentioned, there are these evacuations of children and also these psychological studies that are intended to understand what impact the separation of children from their families and especially from their mothers would have on their development, their personalities, and their mental development. These studies are conducted by well-known psychologists like Anna Freud and Susan Isaacs and John Bowlby. And the consensus that starts to emerge from them is that taking children, especially young children, away from their mothers was profoundly debilitating and could lead to long-term traumas that would that were associated with a range of sort of scary dangers, like higher rates of juvenile delinquency, criminality. You know, there's a range of arguments that are made about the impact of an early separation on a developing child emotionally and mentally. And so in the period after the war, there's a new generation that enters into social work that is part of the expansion of the welfare state. So many of the new generation of activists are women, and they come in, they're very much informed by the new psychology that's emerging in this period. And they start to look at child migration as really out of keeping with the new knowledge that is coming out of the realm of medicine and science. There is the concept of maternal deprivation, which is an idea that's put forward by John Bowlby, which basically argues that any period of prolonged separation between a mother and a child in the young years of life would lead to problems of attachment in later life, and that that lack of attachment would manifest itself in a number of societal problems. And so that understanding of maternal deprivation in particular informs the ways in which these social workers and new generation of officials are viewing child migration. So there's a strong push against the movement that the charities and officials, government officials who are still proponents of the movement have to respond to in some way. And really my argument is that this growth of a new understanding of childhood trauma and psychology not only starts to make child emigration seem less palpable or less possible in the post-war world, but it also starts to weaken the idea of Britannic global unity. Because even into the 1940s and 1950s, there are British politicians who are arguing that the settler territories are deeply connected through these ties of loyalty and heritage and shared belonging with metropolitan British society. And the new way of thinking about psychology and child development, it really is at odds with that sense of a global race of people, because now it seems like the attachment between or the sense of belonging that develops within particular places is very, very local. And it's very much tied to the relationship within certain families. And so people as a whole seem to be less less malleable and less movable around the world than they were before. And so, yeah, that's the way in which child psychology starts to have these larger effects. And really by the 1960s, there's no way to keep the policy going because it's so hard to recruit children to be child migrants. Families don't want to give them up anymore. And social workers certainly don't want to sign off on this policy that they see as potentially having these long-term damaging effects.
And so the policy sort of, maybe you could say, withers on the vine in the late 1960s.
Yeah, I mean, really, the movement itself remains strong. There are still people involved in the charities who want to find children to send overseas well into the 1960s, but there's just not a population of children that's available to go overseas anymore.
It's very interesting. And then you see, you know, by the end of your book, you're talking about, though the policy ends in the late 60s, there's a significant epilogue to this story, which is that in the 1980s, we see a sudden, we see a surge of activism and the growth of a kind of memory project, particularly in Australia, maybe, rooted in some of the former child migrants' sense that their experiences as such, and I should point out, and it's one of the really most textured parts of the book, I think, is that not all child migrants remember their experiences as child migrants negatively. Some of them remember their experiences with great fondness. Mm-hmm. But in any case, we do see in the 80s a kind of memory project growing out of the sense of some former child migrants that their experiences had deprived them of their true, as they saw it, their true identities. Some felt like they didn't know quite who they were. I wonder if you can. It's a very tragic thing. I wonder if you can talk about some of the things that contributed to this movement.
Yeah, well, the 1980s is a really important time for reevaluating child migration because the policy sort of withers out in the 1960s, and then is not really talked about until a number of activists start making claims in the 1980s that the policy was abusive and that the governments, especially of Britain and Australia, need to be cognizant of that and acknowledge the sorts of abuses that were perpetrated against children and to provide forms of compensation in order to allow former migrants, who by that point were in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, some sort of a way of coming to terms with their experiences. And what I found really interesting is why that happens in the 1980s. And it seems very much connected to a redefining of belonging in various parts of the world. So in Britain, there is an adoption rights movement that gains steam that starts to argue against the concept of a closed adoption, where a child will be sort of adopted away from their birth mother, and then there will be no connection between the birth mother and the child after the first initial adoption. And there's a movement towards open adoptions in order to give children a clearer sense of what their background is, really the story of their lives and who their birth parents were, and to regain some sense of contextualization for their early childhood. And that movement is coming at really the same time in Australia and Canada as an Indigenous rights movement that spends a lot of time discussing the removal of Indigenous children from their families throughout the 20th century and the really traumatic legacies of those removals. So most notably in Australia, you have the Bringing Them Home report, and which emphasizes the traumas that were created in the stolen generation of Aboriginal children who had been forcibly removed from their families and resettled either in group homes or with white families throughout the early to mid 20th century. And so both of these movements are articulating forms of belonging that are very much centered on the importance of knowing your background and knowing who your family is, and the centrality of those sort of natal connections to the emerging sense of self of a person. And so within that, you see also this kind of idea of the importance of understanding your background and understanding that connection to your family life, also influencing the ways in which child migrants thought about their experiences. And many started to see their experiences of removal from their families at a young age as very much on par with this larger sense of trauma of not knowing where you come from. And so many activist groups start to make the argument that what former migrants need to do is have access to their case history so that they can know who their parents were and maybe go back to the UK and find their families or relatives. And there's a really strong sense of urgency, sort of an awareness of the fact that their parents are older. Many of them had already died. And so a sense that that connection needs to be reformed very quickly before the chance is lost, which leads to a government response. I mean, the response doesn't happen until much later, until the early 2000s. But there is, by 2009 and 2010, official apologies that are issued by the British government and the Australian government for their participation in the child migration scheme, and compensation packages that are created that really facilitate journeys of child migrants back to Britain in this attempt to allow them to rekindle some sort of a connection with their families.
Yes, it's very interesting. Some smart historian one day is going to write a book about what happened in the 1980s that led to heightened interest I'm trying to think of the right way to put it, but there we see other kinds of you know, really crucial memory projects developing in other parts of the world at almost the same time. Right. I'm thinking about the sort of global rise of Holocaust consciousness as one example, but it's very interesting the specificities of this particular of the example that you're talking about of the child migrants, particularly in Australia, and the both the examples of changing attitudes towards adoption and the open adoption movement, but also of Aboriginal peoples in Australia and the sort of the way that the movement of child migrants to have some acknowledgement of their past and their own identities dovetails with or actually grows out of those other movements about belonging and memory. I think that's really interesting. You know, Ellen, we've taken up an enormous amount of your time, and you've spoken so wonderfully and eloquently about your book, and I hope that lots of people will, upon hearing this interview, rush out and purchase it, or at least go and find it at their local library. But since we've taken up a lot of your time, maybe you'll just, you know, indulge us with one, with the answer to one more burning question, which is, I hear that you have a very interesting new book project underway, and I wonder if you would tell us just a little bit about that.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, thank you so much. This has been really fun, and it's always nice to get a chance to talk about your research,
especially of course,
in a more extended way. So thank you very much. So yes, I'm working on a new project, which is really tangentially related to my work on children. I'm interested in understanding changing notions of survival within British culture throughout the 20th century. And the main question that I'm asking in this project is, as the technologies and experiences of warfare shift over the course of the 20th century, from, for instance, the advent of aerial bombing and gas warfare in the World War I period, through the nuclear threat in the Cold War era, how does individual and community and societal understandings of survival shift along with those the changing nature of warfare? So it's a very big project that I'm just beginning, but it's a really fascinating project because it leads me into all of these different archives to try to piece together a story of how, for instance, the notion of survival skills is first invented in the empire and brought home to Britain, sort of how first aid classes developed and how they get to be disseminated within British society, through to debates about hoarding and shelter culture during the Second World War, up to sort of the vibrant survivalist community that starts taking shape in Britain in the 1970s and 1980s. So all of these ways I'm thinking through sort of the nature of what it means to survive and how people use sort of an understanding of survival to get at larger questions about citizenship and political belonging and the nature of the community, the national and local community in the 20th century. So yeah, we'll see where I go from here. It's still in the early stages, but I'm really excited about it.
I think it sounds phenomenal. I think it sounds like a huge topic, but I think it sounds like a really, really rich one. And I wish you a lot of luck with that. We've been speaking with Ellen Boucher, who teaches history at Amherst College. And she's recently published a book called Empire's Children, Child Emigration, Welfare and the Decline of the British World, 1869 to 1967. And we've greatly enjoyed talking with her about it today. Ellen, thank you very much. And best of luck with everything, especially the new project.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Monica.
Okay, take care.